This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm your host, Bill Radke. It's great to have you along. At the Seattle Police East Precinct building, a fake tombstone and a Trump flag, the Seattle Times fires its brand new editorial board member after one column and some tweets. These stories and more are just ahead as we review and discuss the week's news with my panel of journalists, Seattle Channel host and producer Brian Callinan. Hi, Brian.
Great to be here, Bill. Thanks.
Political analyst and contributing columnist Joni Balter. Hiya.
Hi. Good afternoon, everybody.
Great to see you. KUOW online editor and producer Dyer Oxley. Welcome back.
Good noon, everybody.
Good noon, sir. 12 bells. And we are streaming this visual-like as well as we do on YouTube and Facebook, so you can come watch the show online if you like. Okay, well, first topic. This week, Seattle hosted the Major League Baseball All-Star Game and its related events. Brian, you went to the Home Run Derby.
It was so awesome.
Yeah.
Julio Rodriguez set that record of 41 home runs in the first round.
He's a Mariner.
He's a Mariner, and he's a stud. Did he follow through the whole way? No. And I got to give extra props to Adley Rutschman, who was a catcher for the Orioles. Switch hitter. So he hit it from the left-hand side to start and then switched to the right-hand side. It was pretty impressive.
Impressive.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, it's not quite like a real home run. There's not a major league pitcher trying to strike you out.
Oh, gosh, no.
Or an outfielder trying to, you know, snag the ball.
But it was electric. A lot of fun.
Yeah. Leading up to this, by the way, anybody else do any related events?
I watched the traffic.
You watched the traffic? That,
yeah. I watched the games.
You watched the traffic derby?
The traffic derby on I-5 to get home.
It was pretty good derby, right?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty great.
I enjoyed the free bus rides. But leading up to the fun, there was a lot of talk of what the city should or shouldn't do to make SoDo look like a place where people don't live on the streets. And Joni, overall, what did the city decide to do?
Well, what they did was they did some cleanup throughout the city and especially close to the ballpark. And then they were kind of funny about the cleanup near the ballpark. They were clearing encampments. And I guess the Thursday before the game, there was a cleanup near the stadium. And then this bizarre quote saying, you know, that it wasn't tied or connected to the All-Star game.
A quote from the mayor's office?
A quote from the mayor's office and someone I didn't actually recognize. We have not changed our process or approach for citywide encampment removals in the lead up to the All-Star game. Yeah, right. Why not just say what you're doing here? So that quote just had everybody just laughing. We know, like when you have guests coming, may I ask all of you, do you dirty up the house? Do you clean it up? I've got my daughter coming here. I haven't stopped cleaning every day. So I think that is pretty normal. And you should just be honest about it. What's the jive about? I don't get it.
I guess I'm a little less concerned about the story that came out of the mayor's office as to why these cleanups happen and really what happens next. Because specifically, they were really targeting an area that had a lot of RVs. And so these RVs were cleared out. And so my question is, where do they go next? And I'm really looking at what the city is doing in the month of August, just a few months or a few weeks from now. They're setting up a new safe parking lot for RVs in the Inner Bay neighborhood with 26 spaces. Is that enough? Absolutely not. It's going to be run by the Low Income Housing Institute. And I'm really interested to see what happens next because it sounds like people will come in with RVs. And then the goal is, guess what? That RV stays here because we're going to be putting you into housing. Now, is this going to work? I'm not quite sure. The city hasn't had a great track record with this, dating back to 2016 when they first tried this. But I'm interested to see what happens with this version of it in Seattle. I will point out, lastly, that there aren't that many providers that are interested in doing this kind of service. The city of Bellevue has set aside some money to actually do this, and they can't even find a provider that's willing to do it. So I think there's a few different moving parts here, and I'm interested in what happens next.
You know, to go back to your first point, too, Joni, that Yeah, I believe that the city did go through with its normal process. Like, I totally take that quote on its face. I also believe that the city knew when All-Star Week was and when they could start that process, you know? So, I mean, yeah, so cities do this. We do it for the Olympics. We do it for World Cup. Vancouver did it. But to kind of go back with your metaphor of cleaning up your house, in my house, we have the room. We call it the odd room. And when we clean up, we don't really clean up as much as we just take everything and put it in that room. That's kind of how Seattle operates, right? We know we have this crisis, a homelessness crisis. We know we have these issues. And kind of pat ourselves on the back every time we go through an area and say, okay, hey, we took care of this area. But people in Lake City know, you know, what happens. And people in this other part of town know what happens. We're just kind of moving things around with not really getting to the root problem. I think that's the larger conversation around this.
Yeah. And there is a larger conversation, and it is fair, but if we're just assessing All-Star Week by itself, that's where I was going. But clearly, and we're trying so many different things in this city, and we're succeeding at some, and we're failing at others. And, you know, hats off to the RV park that opens next month, and hats off to so many different programs that we're doing, and a lot of money is being spent and a lot of effort is working and some of it doesn't. But, you know, this is a problem plaguing the entire West Coast. It's not something unique to Seattle, and we have to be mindful of that, and we have to try to do the best work that we can so we're not like some of the cities. San Francisco's the obvious one that's really suffering from some of the things it didn't do or wouldn't do.
Well, we might get into some parts of this when we talk election here in a few minutes. But finally, on All-Star Game, did everybody benefit from the events who expected to benefit?
A lot of people did. I know that there were some of the different hotels. They certainly saw a big boost. The downtown core, you were saying?
Even on the hotels, you know that there was 90% capacity. We were at 90% capacity last summer.
Right.
And so you got to kind of subtract before you get into their like 50 million, you know, multiplier fake number.
I'd say all of Georgetown's pinball machines benefited from me waiting out that traffic I
mentioned. Okay. So you really distributed the goods around the
quarter
city.
By quarters. Yeah.
Well, we also know that
fiscal quarter.
Chinatown International District was ready and raring to go to benefit and didn't feel in the end many of the business owners there that they did benefit from it. So it wasn't everywhere, and it probably wasn't their number either.
People parked there in Chinatown and then followed the arrows to the activity that surrounded All-Star Week. And so I think that's important to point out. Chinatown ID has been a very active political place over the past couple of years here. Certainly very active with King County last year when they pushed back against the expansion of that shelter that was going on there. So I think hearing that voice is important, and looking forward when you talk about events, Dyer, like the World Cup come to the U.S. in 2026.
3 years from now.
It's a big deal.
That's going to be a huge
deal. We're talking about if the nation came to the All-Star Game here, the world is coming to the World Cup. And so how do you branch out those plans? You know, I think it's true.
For those who don't know, it's like it's a half a dozen games or so, right?
Yeah. It's a big deal. Yeah. So, we'll see
matches.
How the different
matches
indeed on the pitch.
On real grass. I think Lumen Field's getting real grass.
They're going to roll out the real turf. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's 3 years off. plenty of time for that. Let's talk. Does Julio Rodriguez have any home runs left in him, or is that it?
Ooh, boy.
I hope so.
Yeah.
He better have a lot of them.
They need to turn it around the second half, for sure.
Another topic. You're listening, by the way, to KUOW's Week in Review, and the Seattle Office of Police Accountability has opened an investigation into the discovery of a fake tombstone in a police break room. This tombstone bore the name and date of death of a teenage black man who was fatally shot by police, and this thing was sitting up on a shelf in the East Precinct building on Capitol Hill, and an attorney who was working on a separate case got hold of police body camera video from inside the break room and noticed this Black Lives Matter tombstone with the name Demarius Butts. Butts died in a shootout with police in 2017. This is his mother, Stephanie, talking to Cairo 7 this week shortly after learning about this fake tombstone.
I didn't think officers would do something like this. Seattle police would do something like this. It's really shocking to me, actually.
And here is a King County public defender who represented the Butts family. Adrian Levitt says he's going to meet with the police chief and ask some questions.
Why this was allowed to happen? What this shows about Seattle Police Department's culture, why anyone put it there, and then why others would see it, and apparently nothing was done.
Then the display was removed, but I don't think we know when or by whom yet. There's an investigation.
The who and the when is kind of the open questions,
right,
on this. I guess when I was considering this topic earlier, my mind just kept kind of going to this. And forgive me for throwing a question out to the room here. But
do it.
You're thinking about home or your workspace. What is on your shelves? I mean, just off the top of your head, what do you keep there?
Sure.
Pictures of my kids.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
I have pictures of Joanie's kids.
Right.
Okay.
Books and
right.
Yeah, a lot of why books, do you sure. Why do you ask?
I ask this because, and we all know why we put books up there, because we want people to see them. When I put stuff around my workspace and shelves, these are moments of personal touches. They are moments of pride. They are things that are out there for a reason. And I keep going back to this video, and that shelf that they have it on is clearly a storage shelf. It's got Ethernet cords and like a mess. It's got a microwave. But that tombstone, I keep coming – that's placed specifically outwardly facing. It really does look as it is prominently featured. It doesn't look stored. It looks displayed to me. And I mean, even if you look at the way that shelf is, it is propped up specifically to be in that place.
Right above that microwave. You can't miss
exactly.
It if you heat it up something in the microwave.
Even
the
way
the
shelf. Trump poster either.
Yeah. The reason I just kind of go through all that is, yeah, I think there is more than enough for people to be really, really curious about the who, the when, and the why around this tombstone. The Trump flag, there's no place for a politics thing, anything, anywhere in that kind of setting. That's kind of a done deal. But that I can't get over just the placement of this thing in there and why anybody would have something there. As a journalist, I'm trying to find the reasonable thing to say, which is it's not a good look.
Yeah.
And I should say the Seattle Police Department says that this might have been something that protesters nearby made. It doesn't change the fact that the question of whether it's on display
you bring it
or
home
not
as a
and why it would be there.
Why is it in a break room?
Right.
I mean, this is clearly disgusting. And, you know, I'm sure we all thought of this. Does it set the city back? Yes. On its effort to come out from under the federal consent decree. And do you want me to elaborate on that? I'm wondering, like the federal consent decree, which talked about Seattle Police Department's biased policing and excessive use of force.
It's an federal oversight because of these
mistakes.
Mistakes.
And as you all, many people know, the police department has been making some great progress, recognized by all. And this is just, as you said, not a good look. This isn't going to help, I don't think. Now, the question is it big enough and awful enough to really set that timeline back? You know, when I was thinking about this, too, I was thinking, you know, many workplaces, old-fashioned ones I'm talking about, would have, like, pinups under, you know. And we can also maybe agree that not all Seattle police officers are super mature. But the question here is, to me anyway, is who was in command staff that walked by that, put stuff in the microwave over and over and over, and said, yeah, I'm cool, no problem.
Yeah,
That's the problem.
It is a problem, and it's a culture issue, and I think that's something that the Seattle Police Department has been working on, and that sounds like a vague thing, but this is what these different agencies that have oversight over the Seattle Police Department are really trying to talk about. Just a quick breakdown on this bill. We're talking about three agencies. You've got the CPC, the Community Police Commission, that takes in public input there. Then you've got the OPA, which we were just talking about, the Office of Police Accountability, that deals with these complaints and makes sure that people knows about them. And then you have the OIG, the Office of the Inspector General. That's the agency that basically takes all this and turns it into policy for the Seattle Police Department. So it's important to look at that three-legged stool, as city leaders call it, to see how this all gets funneled in. And this is something that's going to be investigated by the OPA, and that's very important because the OPA actually just had a report a couple of days ago, right before this news came out in the Seattle Times here, but they actually had a report that went before the City Council's Public Safety Committee talking about, okay, where are we as Seattle police are dealing with different complaints, etc. It looks like with their mid-year report here in 2023, very slightly, we're seeing a bump in biased policing and excessive use of force complaints. These are not full-fledged cases, but just some allegations. So there's a little bit of a bump there. And then very importantly, this is a little behind the scenes, but I think it's important too, The city of Seattle has been pressuring the Seattle Police Department to come through with some different policies, especially with, okay, how do you use these ruses when it comes to different crowd control situations? This was a big deal.
This is when the police deceived the public.
That's right.
Like they said on their radios that there were armed, was it Proud Boy members walking around?
To potentially scare off people who were listening on scanners there that might be protesting, et cetera. So that's a bit of a backstory here, but I think it's important because we have these different situations where the OPA brings these things to the SPD, and there's been some trust put in the department to say, okay, are you going to change these things? What does that policy look like? I know in talking with Councilmember Herbold about this, who chairs the committee, she's saying, we've been waiting a long time for this policy, especially with ruses, to change. And I really think when we talk about these current headlines here, it's another piece to this. What are you going to do to actually change the culture here? Because certainly looking back in 2021, it looks like it's not where it needs to be.
The department has said that I'm looking for their actual words. Basically, that this was not okay. That this, the presence of this
at first
fake
they didn't say that, but yeah.
And this and a Trump 2020 banner. But that's not how they characterized it at the beginning.
Yeah,
right?
I think one of the themes of the week is your first answer is not going to be your best, so maybe don't release it until you think about it a little more.
It was defensive.
Defensive and not productive, which they've been trying to be way more productive.
That
doesn't.
And to their credit, since then, they seem to be totally on board with that OPA investigation and encouraging it, which might go back to that consent decree that they really want to be in line with.
And also trying to figure out a deal for, this is another back issue here that plays a big role here too. We have a Seattle Police Officers Guild, the main union that actually is made up of members of the Seattle Police Department. They haven't had a contract now for 2.5+ years. So how are we going to work all these different issues in to make sure that they're dealt with fairly? How does that work in with the consent decree, which is another moving target here too? So there's a lot going on behind the scenes, but these big, big headlines really don't tell a great story about what's happening within the Seattle Police Department, at least right now. I know Chief Adrian Diaz wants to change that.
And how about the fact that many voters, and I'm not trying to jump ahead to the next topic, want more police? And all we see is declines in the number of officers who can do fast public safety.
Do we know whether that Trump banner was against policy, and would leadership have taken a Biden 2020 banner down, or only if there was one but not both, or what's the policy?
You can look at what is policy and is what is smart.
You know,
is it smart? No, it's not. The Times, I believe, pointed out to an RCW our state law that basically prohibits police on active duty participating in partisan politics, essentially. And if that's the case, you might have something there to say that that's not okay from statewide perception.
Even in the break room and not on the street?
I think that would be on duty.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Everyone knew when the cameras came along, there was going to be a lot of footage and it was going to show a lot of stuff. So I can't believe people don't realize that the break room should be included in that.
And so interesting to me that we would not have even known about this footage
without the camera.
Had it not, well, not without the camera, and also just an investigation into what's happening with the constitutionality of SPD enforcing graffiti laws. So there's a lot of different pieces involved here. So there's a lot going on with the SPD. I know the chief, who is just recently the permanent chief, has a lot to deal with here, but this is part of the process moving forward for the department. Are they in a better spot? We just need to see some changes, I think, over the next couple of months here. And this consent decree is going to be front and center on that.
Yep.
Something else happened this week that offended a lot of people. It involved a brand new hire at the Seattle Times, their new editorial board member. And we're going to tell you that story when we return after a quick break. You're listening to KUOW's Dyer Oxley, political analyst Joni Balter, Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan. This is Week in Review on KUOW and on YouTube and Facebook if you search KUOW Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke, and we'll be back after a short break.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle Times just fired its newest editorial board member after one column. David Volodsko, hope I'm saying that right, is new to Seattle. He wrote about coming across the Vladimir Lenin statue that's been in the Fremont neighborhood for 30 years or so. Volodsko wrote that his grandfather, who escaped a Nazi concentration camp, had said that that wasn't as bad as Russia under Lenin, who was also a mass murderer and torturer. And when some readers objected to his column, Volodsko went on Twitter and continued to compare the two dictators, writing, quote, "Hitler only targeted people he personally believed were harmful to society, whereas Lenin targeted even those he himself did not believe were harmful in any way." And again, he was quickly fired. Joni Balter, you used to write Seattle Times columns. What was your reaction?
Well, several. First of all, the tweet's gone and he's gone, as you said. Seems like the firing after one column and one, you know, really awful tweet is an overreaction. I mean, could we talk to him? Could he write another tweet? You know, and also don't forget the column itself is not the issue here, because if you write a column for the Seattle Times, you have the implied endorsement of the board, because they edit your piece, they mm-hmm. place your piece. Mm-hmm. So really what got him in trouble, duh, for everybody, Twitter, because you cannot have this very nuanced conversation at all on Twitter. You're just going to end up making a mistake. And the other big mistake here is, I don't know if you want to go around in general comparing mass killers. Like, how can you
and
win
one's
that
better than the other? Sure. Right.
Tell me how you're going to win that argument, because there's so much venom left after mass killers do what mass killers do. So I just think it was dangerous territory, the column itself. But I also think firing a very talented, seemingly talented journalist over, his First Amendment.
What makes you think he's talented? The column itself?
Well, I didn't love the column, okay? And I don't even get the Lenin statue. I always thought it was some quirky, how Fremont can you be? People's Republic of Fremont.
Sure.
I never really got it. I never spent a lot of time thinking about it, which is maybe why I didn't understand it so well, why it's there. But I just think that, you know, you must have had a reason for hiring him. Could you sit down and tell him to get off Twitter? Mm-hmm. Could you sit down and say, when the column comes in? I had columns killed. I'm proud of them, you know?
Yeah.
But just kill it if you can't handle it. I just think he deserved another shot. How about one more column? More tweets.
He wasn't afraid to mix it up, that's for sure, because he's coming in new to town, observing something with some fresh eyes there, and coming out with a column that, I mean, if you looked at any of the comments that were on that thing, I mean, they were coming in by the hundreds. And so in terms of garnering some eyeballs, I mean, was doing that. But it really was that tweet that followed that really sank this thing. And like you say, this idea of comparing mass killers and who, that was very, very strange, way to approach that. And I think that's what ended up having the Times letting him go.
You know, I've moved through different journalistic worlds, and one of them was talk radio, and my mind couldn't help but go to that not only when I read the column, but when I saw that tweet, because I've met these personalities before. They get into news and media, but they want to, as you say, mix things up, and that's kind of half the goal, and that's the vibe that I got. I mean, now, he violated Godwin's law, which is never a good thing. It's pretty basic, which is essentially, if anybody brings up Hitler, you lose your argument right away, because everybody does that. That's kind of where I went with this, is just somebody is just trying to kind of garner attention and mix things up. I'm surprised that it's the tweet thing that is what ultimately nixed him, and yet Seattle Times has kept the article up, has kept the column up. I feel like they're kind of a pair in this case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so you asked earlier, so where else has this person worked? According to his Twitter site, which is a dangerous spot, obviously, New York Mag, The Nation, Foreign Policy, New Republic, Bloomberg, where I have been a contributor, Forbes, Slate, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. So I just think this whole thing, do not ever go on Twitter and talk about Hitler or any of these other folks. And I also don't buy.
You had me at don't go on Twitter.
But wait a sec. But also the idea that this guy is somehow pro-Hitler. I mean, can we just go to the next page on his bio? He's a Jewish person. His grandfather, as you said, somebody said was a Nazi killer or ran away from the camps. I mean, this is not in defense of Hitler. But just it doesn't belong for sure on Twitter. That's
well,
that's a fact.
I'm curious. I have a reaction to that. I'm curious what you all think. But okay. It's not the first time somebody has debated the Lenin statue in Fremont. This has been an old topic of conversation. It's a fair question of whether times have changed and that Fremont is no longer associated with, hey, if it's at Fremont, it must be kitsch. You know, it must be quirky and ironic. And that's a fair debate we can have. And I have heard, so just regarding the column, my problem with the column was it was done. You could talk about the change in context. You could talk about emotion. You could say I or he could quote someone who's saying, I feel hurt when I see this statue. And here's why. I feel angry. This is a conversation we can have. But the column had the Twitter vibe to me of it was, I found it snide. I found it, I know what the right context is. I'm right and you're wrong. And that, so what concerned me was that the Seattle Times was, that this is the direction they, I hope this is not the direction they're going to go. You use the phrase garner eyeballs. This is a modern sort of social media way to make an argument. And do we need more of that? Do we need more of the Twitter style? Much less the tweet itself about the Hitler comparison.
Well, you're right about that. You're right that it's fair to look at things in modern context. And in fact, a couple things. Former Mayor Ed Murray said that we should take it down in 2017 for the reasons we were taking down Confederate statues,
right.
You know, sort of in that vein. Okay. And also more interesting to me is that the gentleman from Issaquah who purchased this in Czechoslovakia and what is now Slovakia wasn't into the politics of it. He liked the art of it and, you know, paid, raised money and did all this to bring it to Fremont.
And put it on private property.
And put it on private property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, you're sort of arguing that they hired a provocateur and that they then have to live with it. Or, well, clearly they're not going to live with it, but in their original hiring.
As you mentioned this, I call this Seattle's perennial issue. Because it's just like we always seem to debate. It always comes up. I think
he
layered,
doesn't maybe know that he's new to Seattle, and
that's exactly my point.
Yeah.
Layered over this is this. It's kind of like I'm a newcomer coming in, and I'm going to step into one of the deepest rooted issues that you Seattleites have. I think, yeah, it's you're not going to step too wisely in that. I recall working in Kitsap as a newspaper reporter, and in Paulsbo there used to be a restaurant bar called Helter Skelter, which is a Beatles song. And the owner who I talked to said he did it because he loves the Beatles. But he also says if you tell the story, you tell the full story. So on his sign was a big picture of Charles Manson next to Helter Skelter. And I kind of get his personality. It was very much like, I want to troll people and so forth. And I kind of feel like the Lenin statue has always had that bit of an Archie Bunker trolling type vibe. That's the perception a lot of people have. Then again, I say that, and I don't have anybody who suffered under Lenin, you know, in my life. I don't have that connection. But it does make me wonder that, is it worth just these culture war controversies that we keep on having that ruin everything for everybody at this point with the whole Lenin statue? Is it still worth it today?
I don't know. I just wanted to bring up one thought that I had with this. When you talk about these different types of items being on private property, et cetera, the one that I always think of is driving down I-5 south of Chehalis in Lewis County, the Uncle Sam billboard
there. You shouldn't be on I-5,
right.
I guess.
Well, I guess. And, you know, all the different things that are said there. But again, private property, these are messages that are put up there. They are meant to provoke people. And so how do we control those messages? I think it's a good conversation to have. I don't think Twitter is the best place to have that conversation.
Well, for sure. One other thought. When I saw this column and I was like, oh, newcomer to town, fresh eyes on really tired old topic. But sure, let's hear what he has to say. And then for this to be like, this wasn't even the point. You know, exactly. It wasn't like who's better because they all are horrifying and you just don't want to go there. But I didn't mind it that it was, newcomer comes to town and says, let's take a look. Okay, let me think about it. I hadn't thought about it in a long time.
Yeah, agreed. If you're going to write it well, but that's subjective, right?
Right.
That's why we're talking about it. Okay, so I don't know that you'll hear that name again, the Seattle Times newest and most recently departed editorial board member. Okay. Since we've talked around this a little bit, as we talk about changing Seattle, right? The changing context of Seattle, the changing, a moment ago we were talking about policing in Seattle. It is time to vote. The ballots went out this week for local August primary elections and ballot measures, tax levies and propositions, and we cannot discuss every measure and candidate. The Seattle City Council primary alone has more than 40 candidates. So what is, Brian, what's a larger theme then of this election, or what are the stakes?
I think the stakes are huge because we're talking about a city council that's made up of 9 members. There are 7 positions that are up for election here, and we're talking about a number of incumbents that have decided not to run again. So we're talking about a potential sea change for the Seattle City Council. I'll add on top of that, the citywide position 8 person on the Seattle City Council right now, Teresa Mosqueda, is running for county council. So there's a possibility we could have 8 new council members by the time next year rolls around. So think about that. Mm-hmm. That could be a really big change for the city council. That could be what we have considered more of a progressive council right now. Could it shift more moderate? Some of the dollars that are going into the elections right now might suggest that. So I think this is potentially a change for Seattle. I think some of the incumbents are concerned about that message, of course. And so I'm very interested to see certainly where the votes go, where the dollars go. But we're talking about, again, more than 40 candidates getting involved here. I think there is a push to bring in some new voices. And I'm very interested to see what the discussion is after August here once this gets whittled down.
Seattle has a bit of a blue versus blue dynamic,
for sure.
Kind of what you're commenting on.
That's right.
But now we've entered this era where it's kind of like, which blue are you? You know, and I feel like with the council races, it's a little bit of a tug of war between the direction of Seattle. Which shade of blue are we going for? Some folks have made some arguments about Harrell was elected, Nelson was elected, maybe even Ann Davison was elected. You can comment on that either way, but does that indicate some sort of new direction that voters are leaning into now after so many years of leaning another way? I don't know the answer to that, but I feel like that is the number one question mark on this upcoming election. Is this a trend or is this just a fluke?
Okay, I'd like to answer that in a Dan Strauss incumbent tweet from, I think it's from today, in which he says, this is his site or something, defund the police was a mistake, says Dan Strauss, who was a very enthusiastic supporter of defund the police. So he's taken it back in front of his vote.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks volumes, absolutely, because if you meet with some of these candidates, a lot of them, maybe their favorite word is practical now, pragmatic, that kind of stuff, and you don't hear any bragging about defund the police. In fact, it's sort of more popular to say, we really have to deal with public safety, number one issue. We have to add police to the budget, even though, you know, some of our relationships with police are still very troubled. So I'd say it's way less about ideology this time. It's about sort of the basics of government, like public safety, like dealing with the homelessness crisis, which is, you know, for every city and for us for a very, very long time.
Well, that depends whether voters elect or reelect candidates who are saying defund police was a mistake. But are there also candidates in the mix who are saying that, who are still supporting defunding police, or is that a non-discussion?
I don't think you'll hear that phrase used as much.
Yeah.
But in terms
as much,
of,
yeah.
Yeah. But I think there's a thought behind it in terms of police oversight and what needs to change about the police department that still is part of the conversation. And it's definitely part of the conversation because the city of Seattle is working on this right now. How do we respond to 911 calls in a different way? We don't always need officers out there. And you'll hear that from police officers too. So how do we have this alternative system where we're going to not send police officers? We'll send social workers out there, people who can actually help with these person down type of calls, the lower acuity type of calls out there. So I think there is a changing conversation that's going on about police. I hope that doesn't get caught up in in this whole rhetoric over defund the police versus not, that needs to keep going, and in my opinion, because I think it's an important way for the city to grow. However, this whole concept over defund the police, it's going to be a big part of the different debates going on. I think there's a lot of candidates that are walking away from it. Andrew Lewis from District 7 walked away from this position a couple of years ago. So,
but he's walking in circles some days, too.
He can be. Yeah. He can be, sure. But I think that phrase is just so electric and such a lightning rod here. I think a lot of candidates are walking away from it and trying to, I think, maybe be more practical about what we want out of a public safety umbrella here. It's not just police out there. And I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Okay. Well, I think we have some statewide issues as well, a little bit further down the road. But anything more on city before we leave that? Okay, enough? Because the statewide elections are not until next year.
Right.
But what should we know about, let's say, the campaign for governor?
Well, you should know that a big candidate just entered the race. Mm-hmm. And Dave Reichert, former sheriff of King County and longtime congressman from the 8th District. And he's in the race, and it changes quite a bit about it. You have three Democrats that had already announced and were, you know, figured to be top folks. Bob Ferguson, state attorney general now, has been wanting to run for governor for quite some time. You have Lands Commissioner Hillary Franz and State Senator Mark Mullett. And with Dave Reichert's entry here, and a lot of people are saying, you know, he really has a chance to do very well. Mm. But with Reichert in, it's real trouble for the state senator, Mark Mullett, and probably as well for Hillary Franz, because top two primary can only get two through the primary.
Exactly. Right. I think the Democrats think Reichert can do very well. I mean, immediately after he announced, it was interesting. The announcement came in a 33-second video that was literally just him showing up in front of the camera saying, "I'm Reichert, I'm here, buckle up." Period. The Democrats released videos that were like Hollywood level, inspirational music, 4 minutes long. And that 33-second video had them coming out swinging within seconds. So clearly, the Democrats feel that Reichert is a threat to them in some way, perhaps because it is those top two vote getters. You know, it's going to end up being a Democrat and a Republican. Now they're maybe trying to buy, I want to be that Democrat.
Yeah. And I think they're going to be attacking Reichert on choice. That's a huge part of it in terms of abortion rights, et cetera. And I think that's where you saw those ads from the Ferguson camp.
Right.
You're right. They came out literally right after Reichert announced. And then there was a little follow-up in case you missed it on the Monday right after. So I think that they're very aware of Reichert as a competitor here. I will say that Ferguson has the war chest to be working with here, $3 million and counting. So he's a big, big leader in that department. I'll be interested to see where the money goes with Reichert in the race here. Again, more of a moderate Republican, has been critical of President Trump in the past. I think that's something else the Dems are going to try to attach to him. Hillary Franz said, hey, guess
what?
Has been
critical of Trump?
He has been critical of Trump and said, you know,
I'm right. He voted with him a lot, but he's also been critical. So
right.
He has both of those.
Wrote in Mike Pence as a candidate rather than Donald Trump for president, et cetera. So I think there are some ways that he's going to try to distinguish himself.
Are you saying the Democrats are going to be publicizing his own statements to try to turn Republicans off of him who are more of Trump fans?
Turning moderates, I think. I think there might be some disaffected Democrats out there who might be looking for another choice.
Well, they're gonna go after him on choice, like you say.
Yeah,
that is, you know, this is a moment in time, and other states are doing some wild things on choice, and so he's going to have to live with that one.
Yeah.
Okay, final thing before we take a break. There's news in the campaign for the position that Bob Ferguson is trying to leave, Attorney General.
U.S. Attorney Nick Brown has jumped into this, and I think he's going to be a
Democrat.
The Dem is going to be a big leader, former Governor Jay Inslee counsel here. So he's up against Maka Dingra, the Senate Law and Justice Chair from Redmond. I know she got a few people upset with her position on police pursuits over this past legislative session. So those are the two big people that I'm keeping an eye on.
That's another blue versus blue kind of situation, too. I think
so
Brown is angling.
So far.
Yeah, I think he's angling for more of the moderate side of things, from what I can tell initially. This might be neither here nor there, but is anybody expecting Lorena Gonzalez to dip her toe into this at all? Because I remember the last election cycle, by mistake, her campaign video for AG went out really quick, and then it turned out Bob Ferguson was not leaving and had to pull that back. So yep. I've been kind of wondering about that.
Hmm. I'm not sure. She's been
in
Olympia.
I haven't heard her name at all, but also there's a lot of Democrats already in, and I think a lot of folks are going to be coalescing around Nick Brown just for his incredible resume and stuff. And I think Jay Inslee might have endorsed him already.
His former counsel. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
He's a survivor.
Yeah, right. That's a good way to look at it.
So finally, ballots went out this week. How long do we have to return those ballots? Anybody remember the
What is that date in August? It should be right.
August 1st is the primary.
Yeah,
right?
There we go.
Yeah, August 1st.
Usually 8 p.m. by
8 p.m. August 1st.
There
Get them in. Okay, we're going to, this is KUOW's Week in Review. We're on Facebook and YouTube. Thank you very much. So find us there, search KUOW Public Radio. We're going to take a short break. We're going to recharge our batteries and then talk solar power, so stand by. This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm not alone. I'm with political analyst Joni Balter, and Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan, and my partner, my colleague, KUOW online editor and producer, Dyer Oxley. Running down the week gone by, you know, something we rarely badmouth in this region is renewable energy. That is nothing but good, you might think, except that the big renewable energy developments tend to be in rural areas, and some people don't want them. Dyer, there's a new project to figure out where in our state are the least controversial places to build solar farms.
Yeah, a story by Courtney Flatt over at Northwest News Network had me curious this week. Essentially, Washington State University has developed a new map, and this map is designed to show where are you least likely to step on people's toes if you want to put in a solar project. If you read any headlines about this, you probably hear about folks complaining that I moved to this area for the landscape and the scenic, you know, ambiance, but I don't like these solar panels now that are obscuring the view. But there's these other issues that are a little bit more nuts and bolts, like conservation areas, farm and ranch land, where our food comes from. You know, where are the conflicts there? And that kind of snarls our efforts, especially when we have these goals for renewable energy in Washington State. That snarls our efforts getting solar power into our own state. So this map, hopefully, fingers crossed, is going to kind of fast track those projects, get more solar into this state. There is a notable, asterisk here that these maps didn't take into account tribal lands or culturally sensitive lands. The tribes that Courtney talked to said that there's still going to be on-the-ground surveys that are going to cover that, but there still are other conflicts out there that we could potentially be running into. But good news, hopefully not get some more sooner.
Yeah. I had a question on this one, Dyer. Is there a way, because I imagine part of this whole process is, all right, you are a farmer, you're a tribal landowner. Yeah. What are the benefits that can be accrued by having solar panels other than the energy benefits? What are the benefits, maybe it's some sort of tax write-off or something like that you could accrue by having this type of array on your property?
There are most of the incentives right now seem to be targeted at residential. When you get into an actual farm, solar farm, you're getting more into like companies getting into this. And
okay.
I think you find a lot more startups doing that. Mm. I am not going to even pretend to try to speak on the incentive programs for those. But in those instances, you're most likely just selling off your energy to the larger company in the region, which there are only a handful here. So if you're getting into the solar power market, you're probably going to be one of the only ones around to sell that energy off to PSE and a number of other ones.
BPA, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. I also have a question. Well, clearly, you know, if you're going to do solar development, you have to do it where there's a lot of sun that you can capture. But I don't understand one piece of the process, which is why not include the tribes right from the beginning? Because you are going to just get into so much trouble if you don't.
I think that's a very, very good question. I think the folks over at Washington State University, that's, if you look at their actual study that they did this on, they say that they spoke to the tribes and tried to include some voices there, yet this reporting says that didn't necessarily really happen. Again, there already are state laws and regulations on the books that you're not going to be able to really cross those lands.
Maybe they figure they won't be getting their best investment there because there'll be so many challenges
Right.
Or something like that. But they're big landowners.
Well, you think of Anna King, another Northwest News Network reporter, recently reported on a lot of the lands in Washington and Oregon that are still used for foraging and growing by a lot of native tribes.
Yep.
That's the kind of conflict you're going to run into. You might look at a bare land, but it's not really bare. There are things there that you can uproot and eat and consume that a lot of tribes are still subsisting off of these days. And that's the kind of issue you run into.
If a tribe or a farmer or a rancher doesn't want a solar farm there, they don't have to put it there, right? What do you mean that there's a conflict regarding farming or ranching?
It could be also the thing about next door. I think the most understandable conflict you have is something like conservation land, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have a plot of land where there is probably some benefit that you just don't see right. We have a lot of critters in this area, some on the endangered species list. We have a lot of ecosystems that we don't want to disrupt. You look at how dams disrupted salmon runs, and we didn't really expect that at the time, but now we're dealing with that now. So what are you going to put in there today, 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road, is going to harm wildlife in conservation areas? What are you going to do my farming experience consists of my backyard plot that I just pulled cabbage out of. Mm-hmm. But
I have a worm farm, so I'm pretty much an expert.
You and my wife would get along. She's really into the worms. Anyway, yeah. the farmlands, I'm not quite sure why a farmer, and if anybody knows, I would appreciate your thoughts, dyer@kuw.org. Wouldn't necessarily want that next. I feel like you would be a direct beneficiary of it. But then again, yeah.
Well, I also think, and this is slightly off the topic, but I also think that Eastern Washington is viewed as a good place to do some of our new green jobs kind of thing. Because this week, this Silicon Valley startup called 12 opened up a plant that's going to produce sustainable aviation fuel.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so I don't know. Moses Lake. So are we going to start to really see some of the green jobs in Eastern Washington? And this, they complement one another in their own way.
We're going to have some green jobs in Seattle, too, because I believe a new hydrogen production facility just moved into town. Green jobs is the future of kind of like the next frontier of industrial revolution that we're going to have. So Eastern Washington is, I believe, going to pump out a lot of those jobs, mainly because there's nothing really there to compete with it at this point.
And when you talk about our state trying to use all renewable energy, I think the target is 2045, which isn't all that far away when you think about it. Does this whole concept of installing solar farms and trying to do it in a more expeditious way, are we going to get there? Do you have a feel about that big, big picture?
There's an official state answer to that, I'm sure, that is out there. Personally, when I look at these things, I kind of think maybe not going to reach that right away.
Does hydro enter that conversation?
Hydro enters this conversation. In some circles, nuclear enters this conversation. They are definitely working on more mobile nuclear production facilities in our own state right now. Winds, which we already have, but we're also looking at offshore at this point.
I
haven't heard anything about tidal energy, and we have a whole Puget Sound here that has a lot of tidal energy, and I haven't heard anybody talk about that. We have a lot of patchwork options in this state, which seems like that's the future of renewable at this point, especially if you want to start weaning yourself off those fossil fuels.
Mm. Yeah. Super interesting.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for drawing attention to that Northwest News Network piece. Finally, we've got 4 minutes left in our week in review, and I always try to leave listeners with something to smile about. Earlier this month, I followed up on the name Atlas. Were any of you on the show when I discussed this? Axios had flagged a baby name study showing that the name Atlas is a trending name for boys in Washington. Trending relative to itself, right? Like it's increasing more so than other states from what I could tell. So, and I played you last time I talked about this because I had asked listeners, who do you name your kid Atlas and why? So I played you a little bit of a conversation with a listener named Karina who named her kid Atlas because her partner was large and her dad's a bodybuilder and she figured her son would be big and his last name is Powers and she liked the name Atlas Powers.
Whoa.
So one more thing. I got an email from a mom named Michaela who said she was looking for names that would make her boy sound like he could crush cars between his fingers, said Michaela. And she told me about that.
You know, we did the usual run through of you say the name and then you say all of the, you know, easy to think of ridiculous nicknames that could come from it. And so Atlas felt pretty safe overall.
Addie.
Passing those tests.
Nobody, you couldn't think of a way someone was going to skew that name.
You know, I did have a coworker who jokingly referred to him as Baby MapQuest for a little while, which I thought was hilarious. But
Atlas MapQuest,
no.
Yeah. Michaela also reflected on the whole idea that you need to give your kid a special name. She says they checked the Social Security Registry for 5 years prior to see how many babies nationwide had been named Atlas, and there were only about 50. And now, after everybody telling him what a unique name it is, her kid's now in school with three other boys named Atlas.
I mean, on the one hand, you know, we go to all this trouble to be so unique. And I'm wondering, it makes me wonder if the other parents had the same sort of, we're going through the same sorts of checks, the same sorts of protocols. We want this to be a unique name. We want it to be uncommon. And if going to all that effort, like we all just worked ourselves into the same place. More or less.
As Michaela told me, maybe it's proof that people are not as unique as we like to think they are.
You know how you test a name like that? What you do is you're going to pick Atlas. You walk into two or three daycare centers, yell the name, and then see what happens. And then you know you've got a unique one or one that everybody already thought of.
I guess this shows where my mind is at, because, I mean, it's like Atlas. Like, are they going to be good at geography or something?
I mean, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, there's the guy, he carried the world on his shoulders. Yes. Do you want to lay that on a kid?
That was my reaction the first day I found out about it. Wow, that sounds like pressure.
Parents, you want a strong name? Kal-El. Okay, Bruce Banner. The names are already out there.
That's true. Yeah.
It's been done. That made me smile, that whole conversation. Anything made you smile this week we can tell listeners about?
I was just thinking about this day 30 years ago. It was Bastille Day. It's Bastille Day today. I was in Paris on the Eiffel Tower watching the fireworks go off. And is it better than the 4th of July? No. USA all the way, for sure. But it's
be careful.
Just one...
Don't put it on Twitter.
Well, no. all I'm saying is it was an incredible moment there, and it just had me thinking, thank you for pasteurization and awesome cinema and great wine and pastries.
Yeah.
Vive la France. That's
Vive
just what I wanted
France.
To say.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything else to smile about before we go?
I was smiling at this sea otter, female sea otter, who's board jacking off the coast.
Paddle boards.
Stealing them.
Stealing surfboards, paddle boards off the coast of Santa Cruz. I mean, it just made me laugh that they've tried to intervene a couple times and they can't seem to stop it. It's just funny. Even the sea animals are kind of grumpy right now, right? Yeah. Difficult. Yeah.
Otters are no joke.
KUW's Mike Davis just reported that Hedwig and the Angry Inch is performing in Seattle. I didn't know that. Now I'm super stoked. I don't like musicals. I like this musical very, very much.
I saw that musical about 25 years ago at the Rebar.
Right.
Nick,
that's the
late
way to see
Nick
it.
Garrison. Yeah.
Check it out at Arts West. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Arts West. Okay, we got to go. Brian Callanan, Seattle Channel. Contributing columnist Joni Balter, KUOW online editor and producer Dyer Oxley. Thanks for being our journalists this week. Love to see you.
Thank you so much.
Producer Kevin Kniestat, social media and live streaming from Juan Pablo Chiquiza and Tio Popescu. Jason Burrows running the board. I'm Bill Radke. Back next week.